This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Joining us this morning is Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell. Morning.
Good morning, Catherine. It's great to be on your show. It's been a while. And I have to say, just listening to news, NPR, HPR, what a gift to our country, to our state. I listen to it every morning as I get ready to go to work and as I drive to work. And it's where I get my news and where I find out what's happening in our community. And it's just a great organization.
Yeah, I have to say it's a treasure.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Well, now you just recently came back from the Mayor's Conference.
Correct.
And we get to host this conference later this year.
Yeah. You know, Catherine, it's a real honor to be able to host. It's been over 50 years since we hosted the U.S. Conference of Mayors. I think the most chicken skin moment, we've done it twice since the Conference of Mayors was created back in the 1930s. And it was when John F. Kennedy came out here in 1963 in June. And of course, he was assassinated in November of that year. His whole speech was around civil rights. Our country is in the throes of the civil rights movement. And he spent a lot of time talking about someday he hopes his country looks like Hawaii in terms of diversity, acceptance, and inclusion. And, you know, you could fast forward to today, a local boy in Barack Obama, Hapa, went on to become president of our country. So this conference, when we start, we're going to show part of the film. He spoke at the Hilton Hawaiian Village in that geodesic dome. The conference is again going to be at the Hilton Hawaiian Village. Caroline Kennedy has committed to come out. We will show us a snippet of that film and that speech. And when the lights go on, his daughter will be standing there.
Wow. Okay. So we have
to talk. And then we're hoping
preview. Wow.
The president and President Barack Obama will be able to make it too. We've been talking to him several times. He has a scheduling conflict he's trying to work out. But again, if we could, the dream is that when she's Powell talking, that he would walk out as that example of inclusion and bringing people together. That dream that President Kennedy had was fulfilled for the first time.
And that's going to be in June.
That's in June, the end of June, June 28th to July 1st. The day before, we're going to have the Climate Mayors Conference up at East-West Center. It's something that the mayors have been getting together since I was elected. They're the mayors of the large cities, not only around the country, but also around the world. We come together, we share what we're doing to deal with the issue of climate change in all the different ways that these mayors are addressing. And so that's going to be a pretty cool event, I believe. It's going to be up at the East-West Center in that beautiful building. And I'm going to be going to Japan next week for a couple of things, but I'm going to meet with Governor Koike, the governor of Tokyo. She's equivalent of the mayor, to see if she'll come out and speak at this on climate change, but also on the Olympics in 2020. Eric Garcetti, the mayor of L.A., will be coming out. He could speak on the Olympics in L.A. in 2028. And I think if I can get those two guys to bookend it, we're going to reach out to the mayor of Paris, Anne Hidalgo, who's hosting the Olympics in 2024. And, of course, is the leader among all the mayors in terms of climate change and the Paris Accords. If we can get her out, that'd be a pretty amazing group of mayors to have to talk about not only about the Olympics but about climate change in their cities.
Yeah, it'll be quite a lead up then.
Yes,
to that event.
That's correct.
A big deal. All right. Well, you know, Mayor, among the headlines this morning, court action on an attempt by the state to collect taxes owed by illegal vacation rentals advertising online, a plea by a group of homeless campers to stop the sweeps in Kaka'ako. There's groundbreaking on improvements to the Honolulu Sewage Treatment Center. And in recent weeks, we've been hearing about the rail audits, planning for climate change, and changing attitudes about record visitors to our islands. But let's start with efforts to manage the runaway vacation rentals here in Honolulu. HPR was in court yesterday as the state tried to get access to records to go after operators who failed to pay taxes on short-term vacation rental property. Let's take a listen to Deputy Attorney General Kirsten Sakamoto explaining why the Department of Taxation, or DOTAX, wants access to Airbnb's records.
Prior to filing this petition, DOTAX had no idea how many taxpayers were out there, that how many hosts were renting through Airbnb. They've now identified 16,000, and you know, we made an attempt to meet and confer with them to try to figure out, okay, if this is overbroad, if there's some other way that we can narrow it down, come back with a counter proposal, and we can figure out, based on your limitations and whatever data you have, how we can go about doing that. But they refused to provide a counter proposal. So it's a bit unfair that they hold all the information and are unwilling to work with DOTAX in trying to find a subpoena with a scope that would address the issue of identifying the unknown tax.
And Judge James Ashford ruled in favor of Airbnb, denying the state's request for a subpoena.
At this point, I am inclined to find that it has not been established that the information sought is not readily available from other sources. Perhaps some of the information is more easily obtained from Airbnb than from other sources, such as from the IRS or from publicly available documents. But in my view, that's not equivalent to an actual showing that the information is not readily available from other sources. The filings that I read prior to this hearing, as well as some of the comments that I've heard this morning, candidly show me that this is what Airbnb and case law would characterize as a fishing expedition.
And that was Judge James Ashford talking about his ruling. And Mayor, we use this because this really points to the complexity of the issue, which is a hot button topic really across the state.
It is, Catherine. Is it, you know, just an aside, Judge Ashford's father, Tink Ashford, was the founder of Ashford & Riston, where I was a partner for 30 years. So brings back good memories of Tink. His dad was an awesome lawyer, one of the best, I believe, in the state. But yes, this is an issue that every county struggles with and the state struggles with. And you heard the Attorney General, Deputy Attorney General, say 16,000 vacation rentals. I hear on the island of Oahu somewhere between 15,000 and 20,000. We don't know exactly because they're all illegal except for 800. So the vast, vast, vast majority of these vacation rentals are operating illegally on Oahu. And we don't know whether they're paying taxes, whether it be the TAT or GET. They're definitely having an impact in our neighborhoods in terms of what our neighborhoods feel like. And I believe they are affecting affordable housing. So, you know, a while ago, we put together a working group, all kinds of folks from Airbnb folks to traditional hotel folks, everyone in between. And we asked for their input to come up with a recommended way to regulate this industry. And through their hard work, last year, at the end of the year, I introduced a bill. It's Bill 89 that's before the council that's comprehensive in terms of trying to address this issue from all sides. And I'm just making it clear, as mayor, I'm not trying to shut down vacation rentals, eliminate them altogether. But how do we regulate it? How do we find the balance? How do we address the impacts it's having in our neighborhoods around our island? You know, if there is 15,000 to 20,000 illegal vacation rentals, and we have 30,000 or so hotel rooms in Waikiki, and we have Lyft like never before, the number of flights coming in here, if we eliminated this industry altogether, Lyft would drop dramatically. It'd probably have an impact on the overall health of our economy, being tourism our number one industry. So having said that, how do we find this balance? And what this bill does is, and this is very rough numbers, it would probably allow approximately 4,000 to 5,000 vacation rentals, whether it be single-family homes in certain very limited areas or B&Bs around the island. 4,000 from 15,000 to 20,000 is a huge drop. But it's a starting point. Now, the council may disagree and want a higher number. I don't want to kill our tourism industry. I want to find balance. And we, as you mentioned earlier, addressing how many tourists are enough. What this bill does, and I think the magic of this bill, it does set limits of where you can have these things. Single family homes that are vacation rentals, you cannot have in any residential neighborhood anywhere on this island should this bill pass. So along the North Shore, along Kailua, along the Kohala area, west side, if they're a home, a single-family home, you would not be able to operate it as a vacation rental. Limited numbers in resort areas, Ko'olina, those kind of places, Turtle Bay, you would be permitted. And then on B&Bs, a number of them, you could still have them. They're hosted, so the impact is less. That means a local family is living in the home where you'd maybe be renting a room or another person renting a room, up to two rooms max. And we've reduced that number, too. When I put in the bill initially before the Planning Commission, it would allow it as many as you want. And we heard from the community. I had to go back to the Planning Commission and say, I'm open to compromise. Let's reduce the number of B&Bs. Let's get the bill to the council so they can start to get the hearing. So it really regulates and allows them only in certain areas. But here's the other magic of the bill, enforcement. You know, we could hire 1,000 inspectors. And they'd be out there inspecting every day because even when you catch someone one time, doesn't mean they're going to stop. Because if you're making $10,000 to $20,000 a month on your home, there's a lot of incentive to do it again, get caught again, do it again, get caught again. And you can't, it's hard to catch people. You got to catch them in the act. You have to have them admit that, yes, I'm renting this place. So there's a lot of fact-driven scenarios. And we do catch people. A lot of times they'll take us to court. And the judge splits the baby in half, and they come back and do it again. So the enforcement is you need to get a registration number. And with that registration number, you must put it on all your advertisements. As you know, these are all hosted sites. If it doesn't have the number, it's a prima facie case that you're operating a legal vacation rental, and you'll be fined $25,000 a first-time infraction, $50,000 a second time, $100,000 a third time. We put a lien on your property, we execute on the lien, and you lose your home. It is draconian, it is very harsh, but we believe that it'll be easy to catch them because they have to advertise on social media sites. We'll probably work with a third party to find these places that are illegal, pinpoint who's doing it, and we find the homeowner, and then we take their home. We think it'll bring discipline. People will get the registration number and comply with the law.
And, you know, critics say enforcement is key because we haven't been able to enforce over the last 30 years, and that's why we're in this situation today.
Correct.
And we've seen a lot of the sentiment about tourism kind of go south because of all the impacts on our trails and our parks and our neighborhoods.
Yes.
And so folks are saying, well, then why not change the laws to make sure that we can do a better job at enforcing?
Right. So we want to know, are you doing it? You got to get a registration number. You give us all the information. We get that information, and now we know who's legal. Anyone else is illegal. If you're on a hosted site with Airbnb or BRBO or any of those places and you don't have your registration number, we're coming after you. Easy to get you. You're going to be fined. You're going to be punished. We think it'll stop the bad actors.
Okay. Well, we have a couple of calls on the line. Steve from Honolulu. Steven, what's your question?
It's more of a comment that we would like to see him enforced. Right now, it's illegal, right? I mean, he just said not too long ago that vacation rentals in residential areas are illegal. So just enforce. Before you make any laws, you can make 100 laws, and without enforcement, it doesn't do anything. Up the street, there's a house with two vacation rentals. They don't care because they know you're not going to enforce anything. People complain, nothing. So show people of Honolulu that you are going to enforce it. Before making any new laws, just enforce. Go after one house if you want. I could mail you addresses that definitely they are illegal. They're in residential areas, and show us. Shut those down and then move ahead. But don't compromise and try to strike a balance with things that are illegal. It makes no sense. It's very illogical.
So I'd want to, you know,
I'd like to thank you for having the Kauai mayor. That was seems like a very good mayor.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Stephen.
So, Stephen, you know, in this provision, there is a strong enforcement measure, as I mentioned. It gives us an ability to use technology instead of people on the ground. You could give us, and we do on a regular basis, get people saying there's an illegal vacation rental. They tell me, I give it to DPP. We send the inspector out there. They knock on the door. No one answers. Unless you actually have someone open the door and say, yes, I'm renting this place for less than 30 days and I'm breaking the law, it's hard to catch them. Now, we do catch people, but it's not as simple as you say. And sometimes they're in homes with gates. You can't get onto the property. We cannot trespass on the private property. So we go to the door, we knock on the door, or we'll sit in a car even and wait for someone, the visitor who's out at the beach, to come home and catch them. But it is very intensive labor-wise. It is very expensive labor-wise. And I'm not looking to grow our bureaucracy by hiring thousands or hundreds of inspectors to try to catch people. I'm looking to use technology to catch people through a registration number. I think it's the way to go. I think it's the way we go in the private sector in terms of using technology. You will not be happy with what we're doing right now. You're not happy. And we do have inspectors, and we do catch people, but nowhere enough to satisfy you because of how it works to catch people. It's kind of like catching someone speeding. You got to be there when they're speeding. Calling and saying, I saw someone speeding down the highway, and the police going, they're not there anymore, they're not speeding, you can't do anything about it.
You know, Mayor, I know I went to an open house at a home in Palolo, and I was there with another family, just happened to walk in at the same time, and I heard the realtor say, oh, you know, this place is already set up. You can just build a wall here, and then you can have two units, and you can do whatever you want. You can make it into an Airbnb or a rental. And this was the realtor talking, telling prospective customers, you know. And so it's just really disheartening to hear that.
So to address that, I mean, along with this omnibus bill, we put two other bills in with this bill. One is requiring that when you sell a home, you have to disclose that this is not a vacation rental is not permitted here. Just like you have to do a lead paint disclosure and all these different disclosures, it's another way to inform, making the realtor comply with the law and tell the purchaser you cannot do a vacation rental. The other one is a bill to make it a criminal offense if you lied to an inspector. To get to Steve's comment, you know, when you knock on a door and they say, no, we're not doing a vacation rental, and then it's how do you prove that they're not? If they lie and we prove that they are doing one, then they are criminally on the line, and we're hoping that will create some fear and that people will not lie. That's part of this package of bills.
And I know your inspectors do go out when they get a complaint, and I have a relative who has an ADU unit, and they went out to rent it. And one of the people that applied, I was told, was someone in a monster home, and the inspectors came, and they said, this is an illegal wall. You're going to have to tear it down. And so then they just said, well, we don't want to be living with strangers. And so they went out and found a legitimate rental, an ADU, to move into. Yeah.
Well, that's a good – that's I like hearing that. Our inspectors are out there, Steve. They go to where we complain, and, you know, I welcome you to either tell HPR, you know, where these places are and give it to me, and I will be more than happy to give it to Department of Planning and Permitting and go out and try to catch these guys. But it's a lot harder than what you think it is. You got to catch them in the act.
And, you know, we've touched on the monster homes and the lack of housing. You just recently announced a plan to try and encourage development in areas that are zoned right. Apartment.
Apartment and BMX, which is business mixed use. As you know, there's lots of monster homes being built. We call them large detached dwellings all around our island. And they're building because there's a demand for this kind of product. And it's not for a single family in Manoa or Palolo or Kaimuki or Hawaii Kai. They're building them with a lot of bedrooms basically as apartments. And it's destroying the nature of our neighborhoods, just like vacation rentals can. And so this new bill we submitted to the Planning Commission would try to take that energy and divert it to where it should be, which is an apartment and mixed-use areas, and incentivize the building of apartments in these areas. And we're hoping it'll have a major impact and result in more affordable rentals at 100% AMI, which for a family of four is about $116,000. That's a lot of money when you think about it. 100% affordable for the life of the project. And I think it can make a difference, particularly in the urban core, where in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and Makiki and Mulili and Macaulay and those kind of places, you saw a lot of these 2-3-story apartment complexes being built. We'd like to see those built even more, maybe some of them torn down and rebuilt. You can go up to 60 feet and house more people in a rental, affordable rentals in the urban core.
Now, we did have another caller on the line. She couldn't stay. Barbara left this comment that she's frustrated that Stephen brought up the issue of enforcement. Now, she apparently lives in Kailua on a block where she says half the houses are either transient rentals and, you know, Airbnbs, bed and breakfast. A lot of frustration out there.
I hear it. And, I mean, I'm out on the streets every day and people come up and I've heard the frustration, which is why we worked hard on this bill. And it's not perfect. And, you know, perhaps it won't go. And we can look at enforcement. We'll continue to enforce. We can hire more people. I don't think it's going to get the result that people want.
We do have a call from Jackie from Kaneohe. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Mayor, I just wonder how you could say that you will not hire inspectors to enforce a law about bed and breakfasts, invasions of our neighborhoods, when you just hired, you're using a bunch of armed guards at parks against your most vulnerable citizens, sir. How do you even answer that?
Well, I guess I'd answer it this way. I didn't say we're not hiring inspectors. If you heard that, I didn't say that. I said that we have inspectors. They're out there inspecting every day. Catherine Cruz mentioned that inspectors have been out there. She knows of cases. We have a team of inspectors that are out there every day inspecting on complaints regarding vacation rentals or even just doing stings where they think there could be a vacation rental. As to your statement of the parks, these guards are not armed. They're not armed guards. They are people who are patrolling the parks and making sure the rules are followed in our parks. And it's made a tremendous difference, Jackie, a tremendous difference in our parks. And it doesn't mean the homeless haven't gone somewhere else, but our parks are for everybody. They're not just for a few who decide they want to go there, whether they have a home or not. And we're going to enforce those laws. And a way to do that is by using the Hawaii Protective Association. And actually, it's less expensive than hiring more city employees, paying their retirement benefits, paying their everything else that goes with it. And if it doesn't work, we'll stop it. But it's been working, which is why we're continuing it. As you see, Iolani Palace are closing their gates because of the same problems we have in our parks. And you see the issues that the Children's Discovery Center is having. We all are living with this. I think it's another way to try to tackle a problem that is impacting our public. And it may not be perfect, but I think it's working.
Okay, we do have a patient caller on the line. Aya from Honolulu, you have a question or a comment about the homeless?
Hi. Yes, I do. I'm actually a social worker. I work with the homeless and the disabled. And from my lens, the homelessness situation has gotten a lot worse in the past few years. And that's largely due to bureaucracy and policies that I see, like such as CellTrack was a recent app that we all have to use now. And it was a policy created, I guess, by DHS. I don't know, but it's extremely redundant, time-consuming. It makes us actually waste so much time dealing with an app and all its faults rather than being with our clients. There's also the VSPIDAT form that homeless people have to fill out that ranks them in order of supposed need. But the problem mainly is that the organization that is in charge of the data is very difficult to reach. And the form can place people high on a list to get housing when they are not, they're very ill-equipped for housing, and can place people in the ranking lower that get housing later that actually could survive in housing more realistically. I also see that AMHD, that's the Adult Mental Health Division, they also have policies that are completely worrisome in that they can abruptly end people's housing if they no longer have AMHD or if they have a different insurance, and it's through no fault of the people, you know, it's not their fault, but they can just abruptly end their housing based on a policy. So I've applied numerous low-income people for housing, and because they make the very low, like, SSI rate of maybe 750, they're placed out of the housing market just even for low income because the requirement is that they have to make twice as much as what the rent is. So, I mean, I have solutions, and I would encourage a dialogue with real people that work in the field and not just, like, bureaucrats, not administrators. There's no—I mean, they do their work. I applaud them. But it seems like there's no dialogue with actual people like me or actual homeless people just, you know, that are in the field, that are in it. Because what is being implemented is not aligned with best practices. It's problematic, and it's created a situation that's already bad, and it's made it worse.
Well, thank you for sharing that insight. I mean, it sounds like you're out there in the trenches, so we appreciate that point of view.
And we would like to include you in a discussion. Now, I'm not in the day-to-day discussions, but, you know, we have a Partners in Care. These are not government folks. These are private folks, not-for-profits, NGOs that are out working with the homeless community. Yes, we have our government guys. We have Mark Alexander for the city. We have our Department of Community Services and Pam Whitty Oakland and some of her folks involved. And, of course, the state does, too, and HUD does. But if there's things we're doing wrong, we want to get them right. All I know is that the city and county of Honolulu, we've housed more people than we've ever housed before. And I think the way you solve the homeless problem is through permanent supportive housing. It's sad when you tell me that we're maybe housing people first that maybe don't need the help, and those who really need the help aren't getting the housing. I want to get people in the housing that need it so they can get stabilized and on with their lives. And I do believe housing first wrapped around with the supportive services is a way to do it. The other thing is we're pushing all these low barrier kind of entries to whether it be shelter or housing. The things the city operates, the Sand Island facility, low barriers, this new Kauili Street, hygiene center, low barriers. I'm for low barriers. It sounds like bureaucracy is creating some problems, some of it maybe by HUD, maybe some of it by Medicare and Medicaid, some of it by the state, and probably some by the city. If there's ways to fix that, I want to fix it. We don't want to make your job harder, and we want to make it easier for people without homes to fill out forms and comply and get into housing.
You know, Mayor, you listed those things. Some of the things that we are doing right that really has made a dent in some of the health and sanitation issues that a lot of the communities are dealing with. That hygiene center, just a big deal. It's a long time in coming. We do have a number of calls stacking up. This is the conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. You can join the discussion today by calling 1-877-941-3689. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.
Aloha. Noe Tanigawa here with an invitation to join us in Hilo on the 8th or Maui on the 9th when HPR presents the best of Aloha Shorts live. You'll experience powerful readings of local literature first performed on the radio program Aloha Shorts. I think you'll enjoy these stories about life in Hawaii told live. So Neighbor Island Ohana, find your seats at hprtickets.org.
Sponsored in part by Kamuela Farmers Market.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to St. Andrew's Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
We've been talking about housing and homelessness, and we have a call from Roger from the Big Island. You have a question?
Hello.
Hi, Roger. You have a question for the mayor?
I do. Mayor, first, I want to. My name is Roger. I'm calling from the Big Island, and I applaud the efforts that you're trying to do with respect to the vacation rental issue. It is an enormous problem, and it's a real difficult one to address. We're struggling with that over here. What gets lost in the conversation, aside from the fact that, you know, neighborhoods get completely transformed by this and it completely violates zoning? I'm a real estate attorney, by the way.
Okay, right.
So I've seen this a lot. I've worked with a lot of realtors, a lot of property owners. And what gets lost, I think, in the conversation often is the impact that the vacation rental matter has upon the price of housing. Both houses for to buy and houses that people can afford to rent. I've seen at hearings people offering testimony saying, well, you know, if you restrict or do away with vacation rentals, it's gonna lower the price of my property. Well, that's kind of the point. You remove thousands of single-family residences from the market, turn them into vacation rentals, you're decreasing the supply. You're increasing the demand, and you're driving prices up. A big percentage of this inventory is owned by people that live off island, and they buy it, and they can afford to buy it because they know they can put it into a vacation rental pool, and that will offset their payments or help with their payments, and they may someday eventually, you know, retire to Hawaii or whatnot. But every time that happens, that's one more single-family residence that cannot be purchased by a local family or rented by a local family. And I think that aspect of the issue has really been largely ignored.
Roger, I think you have some good points there. Again, in the bill that I introduced, we try to address it. I mean, I think you're correct. You know, when you can make $15,000, $20,000 off of your home, let's say in Kailua along Ali'i Drive, you know, it's going to be valued at a higher rate. It's not the same income you'd get if you're renting it to a local family who's working in Kona. And so what we've done on this island, as part of this bill, we have looked at that, is we thought, if you're renting your home all the time, you basically have a hotel or resort on your property, and you're going to pay the hotel and resort rate, which on Oahu is $12 and I think 90 cents per $1,000 in value, as opposed to $3.50 per $1,000 in value. So if you want to do one of these, you know, under the bill I put in, you're going to pay a higher rate. And by the way, B&Bs in neighborhoods, which are limited, you'd pay half that value, $6.50 per $1,000 in value versus $3.50. So there's a penalty for you doing that. And, of course, they're going to have to factor in how many days they have to rent in order to cover their increased real property tax. But it's trying to tell a homeowner who's next door, you're paying $3.50. They're operating a resort. They're paying higher. Now, the issue raised, though, is does it still end up valuing the other home higher, which means the other homes get valued higher and everyone pays more in real property tax? I'm raising it because I don't have an answer for that. But I think you and I are in the same wavelength in terms of the impact it's having on local families and surrounding properties because of the income you can generate off of your vacation rental.
We have another caller from Kaimuki. Carol, you have a question for Honolulu's mayor?
Yeah, I just have a quick statement. It's just a sense of, in relation to the Department of Planning and Permitting, we have a monster house situation, of course, we all know, in Kaimuki and all these other areas. But it would be great to have the head of the Department of Planning and Permitting have a real sit-down with folks, and then also to have each of the inspectors that we have on staff sort of assessed for what they've been doing, basically, for lack of a better word, over the last couple years. We've found that a lack of sympathy and a general sense of apathy with neighborhood complaints and even just updates that have been given to our DPP inspectors. They need definitely more people on force, and they basically, I think, would also do well to have an assessment from up above to see how it's all filtering down to really what's happening in our neighborhood.
That's a good point, Mayor.
Yeah. No, and I mean, I'm not opposed to having a sit down with representatives from different communities, however that is determined. I can assure you that the director of Department of Planning and Permitting is intimately familiar because she's had to go before the council numerous times, and you know she's been beat up pretty badly for what's occurred. Now, there is a moratorium. There should not be any more large-scale homes, detached homes being built. There were permits issued because part of the problem, the way our law was written, it allowed for this. I mean, inspectors go out, but they inspect for the law in place. And unfortunately, the way the law was written, it was so broad that it allowed these larger homes to be built, which are really negatively impacting our communities. I agree with you, Hunter, and I'd be totally upset if one was built next to me. We have stopped it. You can't come down and get a permit today. Now, if someone tries to build one without the permit, that's a whole nother issue. And the council has recently really increased the fines for doing that kind of thing, including making the person tear down what they built. But there are a number that are going through the process that got their permit previously that may be some of the things you're dealing with. In the future, I think this moratorium should stay in place. There should be no large homes allowed on smaller lots. And again, under the bill we just submitted to the Planning Commission, to take that energy that's there and do it in apartment-zoned areas where these kind of projects won't have the negative impact you're experiencing. I think you said in Kaimuki, Carol. But I'll take this back to DPP, and maybe there's a way to reach out. If there's an organization or something of communities that are dealing with this to come in and talk, we'd be more than happy to listen.
I talked to a property owner who said when they had construction, they had the inspector come. The inspector said, oh, you know, you can enclose this at some point later on and, you know, turn it into a rental, you know, as long as no one complains. And it's, you know, what do you do when you've got bad eggs within the department?
Well, that shouldn't happen. That is outrageous. If you can give me the name of the person, I'd be more than happy to go back to the Department of Planning and Permitting and do an investigation. That should not occur.
And then Raina from Kaimuki is not on the line, but she had an issue about inspectors. And she says when the city goes out to inspect, they call the owner to check, so there's time to prepare. She says, what's up with that? You're essentially warning the lawbreakers.
Well, again, government doesn't have a right to go onto private property and to just bust into a home. We all have our privacy rights, and you know, one of the ultimate ones is you're protected inside your home, and we'd be sued if we just busted in without a subpoena or search warrant or whatever. So they're calling because they want to get in to see if it's happening or not. And I mean, I've had limited experience even as mayor. A couple people have told me, hey, there's one going on sometimes in these big homes in Lanikai. And I have the inspectors go out and I said, well, what'd you find out? They go, well, we can't even get in the home because it's surrounded by a stone wall with a gate. And ring the buzzer and no one comes. So what do you do at that point? This is part of that inspection problem. Or even if you can and you knock on the front door, if they don't come to the front door, you can't bust the door down and go into the home without a search warrant. And to get a search warrant, you need probable cause. It takes a lot of effort. And they're usually issued for criminal kind of activity. So this is part of the problem with inspectors. You know, when they say, let's just do inspections, I don't think it's going to get the result that you want. I do think technology and a registration number, we'll know who is legal and everyone else is illegal, prima facie. I mean, on its face, I think that's the better way to go.
Now, Mayor, if we could just turn briefly, I know one of the other things you're talking about is the concern for climate change. You're looking at, you know, possibly raising roads, dealing with the infrastructure that we have to deal with as we upgrade our sewers and our water systems.
Yeah. Now, I think climate change is the issue of our time and will continue to be the issue of our time. We see the limited impacts with the hurricanes that have come laying that was a Cat 5 and fell apart right at the door of Waikiki, basically. The number of hurricanes, the number of rain events. I mean, Kauai with 50 inches of rain almost, East Honolulu. These are going to become more and more common. And we as government need to start to address how we're going to make this a place that we can adapt and continue to thrive in. And I'm devoting my entire State of the City speech to this issue in terms of resiliency. Half of it will be on climate change issues, half it will be on affordability issues. They both go together. How do we continue to live here in a way that we thrive? And so the kind of things we're looking at are in strengthening our building codes to address not only storms, but also how do we not use as much energy? How do we reuse our water? Those kind of things. Those are all part of the resilient part of it. But raising building podiums, you know, Catherine, we're not going to retreat from downtown Honolulu or Waikiki or Kaka'ako. The investment in infrastructure and product is just too great. And I don't think Waikiki is going to move to Kaimuki any more than Manhattan is going to move to New Jersey. And in cities around this country and around the world where there's a lot of infrastructure, both public and private, they're looking to raise podiums and raise streets. And in Kaka'ako, if you go to the Whole Foods, you're actually 4 feet above the street. Merriman's the same thing. All those buildings, the podiums have been raised to deal with future increases in tide. And so we raised the street, and we are looking at doing some of that. So we want to put in laws that in the urban core will elevate. You know, DKI Airport is not going to move to Mililani. The cost of that, runways will be raised. There's enough space on the jetways and all that, but maybe podiums will need to be raised. But on the North Shore, we may retreat in order to save a beach by lighting it a road. And there's going to be huge impact to these neighborhoods that are going to be difficult to address. But, you know, it's not one size fits all. It depends on where we're talking. But it's hardening in certain areas and it's softening in certain areas.
Now, I know the Alawai Canal capacity project is a big deal. There's some concern with the Manoa residents for the basins that the I think Army Corps of Engineers has proposed to deal with our flooding issue and the potential for Waikiki. What do you think about all that?
Well, I can completely understand the concerns of folks, not only in Manoa, but Palolo, where these retention basins are going or proposed to go. And the other aspects of this proposal, including building walls along the Alawai Canal and using our city parks, including the golf course, the Alawai Golf Course and the Mauka side of the Alawai as a retention area should there be a major storm. This all happened relatively quick. They've been planning for years, but Congress at the end of last year appropriated about $348 million for this project. And what they're saying is if there's not a decision made to show that we want to do it, the money could go to other projects in Louisiana or other parts of the country. A lot of money. We don't want to lose it if we don't have to. But working with the community to address their concerns is absolutely necessary. I think there's been a lack of working with the community in the areas where there's direct impact. I mean, they had many meetings. I was the representative of Manoa from 2002 to 2008. Was there when the 2004 flood occurred that caused over $100 million in damage. We say that it's amazing. No one drowned. Manoa got $80 million in damage. The campus there was shut down for a while. So how do we do this in a way where we minimize the impact on downstream residents but not put all the burden and the risk on upstream residents?
And how do we pay for this, Mayor?
The federal government is paying for 2/3 of it. The state city would have to kick in its share, which is $125 million that Governor Ige put into his budget. That's the state or city share. The rest comes from the federal government. 2/3 would be federal funds.
Now, I know that...
And by the way, Catherine, I mean, the easier thing would be to do nothing. And you'd live with the consequences if there's a major flood. And people are concerned on the impact in Waikiki, which is the golden goose, not just for Oahu, but for the state of Hawaii. Almost 6 million visitors go there every year. And if we've been told that if a major flood were to wipe out Waikiki, it would have billions of dollars in terms of economic consequences. How do we find that balance without putting all the burden on the residents who live Mauka of Waikiki?
And we do have a call from Kelly from Honolulu. Your question's about homelessness, I guess, in Waikiki, in the tourist areas, and the concern about that. Kelly, are you there?
Yes. Hi.
Hi, Kelly.
Yes, my question is about tourism in Waikiki. I was in Chicago. I'm from Honolulu. I was in Chicago, and I met this couple who had just come to Waikiki with their son's baseball team. And they said, you know, we never expected there to be so much feel at risk. They said they had a very poor experience because they're like, in Chicago, you expect crime, not in Hawaii. And just they were out to dinner one night, and there were some homeless who harassed them, and they're like, it was a really terrible experience. And hearing that disheartened me. I'm like, we depend so much on tourism for our state to survive, and when it impacts that, you know, people coming their experience, it's like, what are we going to do? How are we going to make sure we keep this tourism population happy and, you know, successful? So that kind of is my question. How are we addressing tourism or homelessness in Waikiki and really kind of doing something to keep them out and find a solution to this ongoing problem?
So, you know, Kelly, it is disheartening when I hear that, too. And it's, you know, I hear this from time to time from visitors and from the visitor industry. Every quarter we meet with the visitor industry. We take half of my cabinet down to Waikiki. We have meetings to listen to their various concerns. And homelessness is at the very top concern for them. And, you know, we get criticized. I get criticized personally for these enforcement mechanisms that we put in place. You know, the first sit-lie bill we did was in Waikiki because of the number of people who are sitting in line and sleeping on the sidewalks on Kalakaua and Kuhio and other places. There's much less today than there was. We passed sidewalk nuisance laws for the same reason. We've tried to deal with the homeless in our pavilions in Waikiki. One of them has a cafe in it where they're responsible for keeping the place open and clean. And we're looking to put out a bid for the other pavilions because the homeless tend to take over the picnic tables and that kind of thing. We have problems in our lifeguard stands in terms of homeless going in there and defecating and having sex and shooting up with needles. And our ocean safety folks have to come in the morning and clean all of this up. So we're looking to enclose those lifeguard stations so they can't go inside. The restroom in Waikiki and Kuhio, we have a security guard there all the time to keep the homeless from damaging the restroom. These things are making a difference. It's not perfect. You know, I put in these two bills, Bill 51 and 52, and now we're being told there's issues with that. Part of it was trying to focus in a more laser-like way on some of these problems. So we're trying, and we need to do more. And you're absolutely right. If there's a bad experience for a visitor and it's reported around the world, it impacts people who come here. But even then, we are a place of aloha. We want people who come here to feel aloha and not to be mistreated. And it breaks my heart to hear what you told me, but I'm not surprised. And we just got to do a better job. We'd like to know where this is, if it's in Waikiki, because, you know, we're pretty good overall in the major thoroughfares. But if they go down to King Street, to Alan Wong's for dinner, or other parts around urban Honolulu or Chinatown, for sure they could have these impacts. And we're trying there too. But if you do know, please let Catherine Cruz know. I'd like to go to wherever that is where they had their bad experience and check it out and see what we can do.
And Mary, you know, you had talked about the cost of the alawai. I was just, I think, wondering the cost in general. If we're raising roads in the urban core and we've got to do this, where's the beef? Where's the money going to come from? I know that there's some issue that the lawmakers have about paying for some of that share for dealing with the alawai.
Well, again, if we're just talking overall in terms of addressing climate change, sea level rise in the urban core, it's not something we'd spend, Catherine, in the next 5 years. You're looking down the road, 2050, the year 2100. But starting now, spreading this cost over a long period of time makes it affordable. But for example, as mayor, we've repaved. We had some of the worst streets and it's county streets. We've repaved 2/3 of them almost. We spent almost $700 million repaving streets. There's others to do. in the time I've been mayor. So what we're talking about is many mayors down the road. As we redo streets in the future, we'd raise the level of the street. And then podiums for buildings that have to be raised. The city that's doing the best job of this is Miami Beach. If they retreat Mauka, they're going to Miami. They cease to exist. So they are raising roads, podiums, parks, on a piecemeal basis. So by the time it becomes a major issue, everything is raised to a higher height. Costs, expensive. To relocate, even more expensive. Spreading it over time makes it more affordable.
Well, you talk about roads. I know safety on our roads is a big deal.
Yes.
We had that terrible crash in Kaka'ako. You had an idea to eliminate right turns on the streets?
Right. So, you know, I put two bills in with the legislature. And, Catherine, next week or the week after, going to be announcing a whole bunch of other ways we can address pedestrian safety that the county can do. The reason why I had to go to the legislature is that right-hand turns on red. County streets, but those are state streets. Even I kind of know, being mayor now, but can I turn red here? Is this on red? Is it a state street or a county street? So if there's a law passed by the legislature for islands with populations over 500,000, which is only Oahu, I don't want to burden the other counties with this issue. All turns on red, you couldn't do. And so I believe we're starting a dialogue. How can we be safer to protect our pedestrians? The other one is the red light photo enforcement. There was a letter in today's paper, a letter to the editor, against it. But we do know people are running through red lights. And in many cities, in D.C., where I just came back from, they've had it in place since my wife was chair of the FDIC under Clinton, where if you drive through a red light, they take a picture and they send you a bill. Just like you get a bill when you illegally park somewhere, they put a cite you and you got to pay the fine, or you can contest it. It works and people are more careful. And I think it protects pedestrians in crosswalks. The rest of the measures are things that counties can do, and in the next week or so, we'll be announcing them at a press conference. All of these things, at the end of the day, help, but two things need to happen. Pedestrians need to be safer. Unfortunately, some are mentally ill or on drugs or alcohol, and they do not sometimes know. That tends to be the homeless population that we see walking down the middle of the streets. Drivers need to be careful. Both of them need to be more careful. We kill more people in crosswalks on the island of Oahu than any other major city in the country. And I want to reverse that trend. And the first step is to at least begin the dialogue and look at bills and other things we can do to make people safer.
You know, it was unfortunate. We did have visitors, I think, that were injured in that crash as well.
And, you know, Catherine, I don't know what we could do about that one. Think about it. We could re-engineer the crosswalk or something, but this was a guy who was driving over 50 miles an hour, had drank a half a bottle of vodka from what I hear, and took a right-hand turn from the far left lane on Alamoana Boulevard. How could we prevent against that other than this guy shouldn't have been driving
and
speeding?
We've been talking a very broad range of issues this morning. I know there was concern about enforcement with our vacation rentals and over-tourism we touched on. And I believe that there is some concern, or I think there was a bill over at the legislature about making sure that, you know, if the counties want their share of TAT, that they're doing their share to enforce the rules.
Yeah, well, here's what all of the counties and the city and county of Honolulu, a place of a million people, I would like the same ability to raise revenue just like the state does. You know, when the mayor of L.A. or San Francisco or New York or Chicago wants to do something, they don't go to the Capitol and say, can we do this? And just returning from Washington, D.C., there were various types of TAT you had to pay for visitors. There was a district one. Or you go to San Francisco. There's a California one. There's a San Francisco one. I would like to have the ability to assess visitors, a county TAT if possible, and the legislature is talking about it. But I'd also like all the other abilities that the state has. I mean, we do a good job, Catherine, here. People may not think so, but we have a AA+ bond rating, one of the best you can get. It was better than the state until recently. We manage our revenue and we control our cost pretty darn well in terms of our budgets. And so I think we should have the tools that we need to raise the revenue we need to provide the services that the people of this island are demanding, including more inspectors for, you know, monster homes or illegal construction or going after people who are doing vacation rentals illegally. All of that costs money. We need revenue for that. I'd much rather assess it on visitors than on the local folks who live here.
Will we hear more about that in the state of the state?
State of the city. We may, but I have just about a half an hour to give it, so there's only so many things I can talk about.
Okay. All right. We've got about less than a minute left. Anything else you want to underscore?
I was surprised we didn't get to the issue of rail. You know, I'm not backing away from rail. I know there's huge controversies, huge issues. I've been there for 7 years now dealing with this issue. I believe it's going to transform how we live on this island. I think it does go to resiliency. It's not about cars. It's about moving a lot of people quickly above the street, not in traffic, using electricity that someday will be 100% renewable, probably before we get all the vehicles on renewable energy. It's transformative. I won't be mayor when it's done, but I think 20, 30, 40 years from now, people are going to say this is the best thing, but we got to get through these issues. I'm not giving up. I'm stepping up. And I hope the vast majority of the people of this island will continue to support the project.
Well, we hope we can have you back again. Maybe
yes,
we can talk about rail.
Yeah.
We hope to have Andrew Robbins on as well at some point in the future.
That'd be good.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Mayor. And we do thank you, the listener, for your patience. We know we didn't get to everybody's calls today. We would like to thank Mayor Caldwell again for carving out time. If your call did not make it on the air during today's discussion, you can still contact the talkback line and leave your comments or questions. That number, 808-792-8217. You can also send us an email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And if you want to listen back to today's show, check out the conversation podcast at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday for more of The Conversation.